This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Feminism in your ears. It's another broad podcast on Joy 94.9. Keep listening. Hashtag feminism. Hashtag podcast. Hashtag broad. On Joy 94.9.
This is Dorinda Cox, Director of Inspire Change Consulting Group. At the National Forum on the Economic Empowerment of Women and Girls, September 5th, 2016. This is broad.
Dorinda Cox. Dorinda is the Managing Director of the Inspire Change Consulting Group. Dorinda is an Aboriginal woman with over 20 years' experience working in government and non-government sectors. Dorinda is the Managing Director of the Inspire Change Consulting Group, where she delivers training, speeches and presentations to a wide range of stakeholders on gender equality. Dorinda represented Australia at the United Nations in 2013 on behalf of the non-government sector and was part of the Australian government delegation at the APEC Women and Economy Forum in Peru in July. Please welcome Dorinda.
Thank you. Thanks for that great welcome. I'm first going to preface this whole keynote address by saying that I had a head cold, unfortunately, that I brought from Perth yesterday evening, which has left me a little bit feeling like I'm in a bit of a wind tunnel. So you'll have to excuse me if at points in this presentation my voice drops out or I feel the need to have a sip of water. So I think it's been a tough couple of weeks being an Aboriginal person, not just an Aboriginal woman here in Australia. We've had lots of ups and downs, from the banana throwing in the AFL to blackface with Nick Natanui, with the death of a young Aboriginal boy in country Western Australia. So it's been a sad week, but we've also had some highs as well in the last month. So we've had Linda Burney entering federal politics, which has been a great... And the 100 days since the Redfern statement being delivered to politics. And I've been watching that with envy on social media. So I'm sorry to say, Mary, but I'm one of those people with the avid followers who watch that with particular comfort and ease. So although I've had partly a heavy heart in the last month because of the race relations here in Australia, I've also had a lot of comfort when I sit on Twitter and on Facebook and watch at some of the real celebrations of particularly women's empowerment, and Aboriginal women's empowerment in this country. So I think that that's a reason to celebrate. I'm going to talk to you, and hopefully I've got lots and lots of slides, but to get through this really, really quickly so that you're not bored and also that I can have a bit of relax. More importantly, so I want to firstly pay my... make my acknowledgement of country, so I wish to pay my respects to the traditional owners and the custodians of the land which we're meeting today, which is the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I want to extend my respect to their elders, past, present and future leaders as well. I also want to pay my respects to other Aboriginal people in the room from other nations, and also to my other keynote speakers. So a good friend of mine, Heather Nancaro, the CEO of Andrews, Mary Crooks, previous keynote speaker from the Victorian Women's Trust. Also, Warren Mundine from the Prime Minister's Indigenous Advisory Council. And it's great to have an Aboriginal man here to provide that perspective today. So thank you, Warren, for being here. I quickly just want to do a brief presentation. Part of my cultural introduction is also to provide a message stick. Now, this message stick comes from my part of the country. It's the Marri tree, and it provides a message, a form of communication about my message for this forum today. It's also about the legacy that I would like to leave. So I'd like Wendy O'Brien as the national convener for this forum to come forward and accept this message stick on behalf of the forum. And this message stick talks about my journey. So I come from the Black Cockatoo, Black Cockatoo people in Western Australia, in the southwest of Western Australia, and I'm presenting this message stick from my elders and my women elders in particular about the importance of social and economic development for Aboriginal people. So, I'm going to, as part of that, also give you a bit of a brief cultural introduction as well about who I am as an Aboriginal woman, where I come from. I'm also going to talk a little bit about APEC. So as Wendy alluded to in my introduction, that I did go to Lima, Peru, and what a fantastic experience that was, and I encourage every woman in this room to put your hand up next year to be in Vietnam at the APEC forum and make that a competitive process for us to represent women in business. And that's such a remarkable experience to be part of the 21 economies discussing economic empowerment for women. I'm also going to link some of those to some of the priority themes and the sustainable development goals, which will be discussed at CSW61 next year in New York. So this is my country. I'm from Kanyang Group, which is part of the southwest corner of Australia, and it's the land of paper bark trees. So if you ever go down Albany Highway towards right down to the tip of southwest WA, about halfway between Perth and Albany, you'll reach a nice little town by the name of Kojima, and that's my hometown. This is my mother's country. This is the New Norcia Mission, which is to the northeast of Perth. The importance of this country is about recognising our matriarchal links. So in my culture, the women in that family are the most important. Our mothers, our aunties, our grandmothers, our sisters are important. And they provide to us the roles and responsibilities of being a mother and being a woman within the family. I'm the mother of two daughters. When my daughters were born, I took their placentas home and buried them on this country because I needed them to understand that their connection to country comes through their mother and through their grandmother. This site is the New Norcia Mission where lots of children were birthed, so it's the old cottages site, and it's next to the actual church. And lots of people have lots of thoughts about Aboriginal people and the impact of the stolen generation. And what I've done is turn that into a positive story, because this is about us embracing this is where the creation comes from as part of our land. This is where lots of our children were born, and we are still connected to that country in some way. I also want to talk to you a little bit about Aboriginal women in business. So over the next 6 or 7 slides, I'm going to provide you with some statistical information about what women in business look like, what Aboriginal women in business look like. This information was gathered by the Australian Bureau of Statistics for the Office for Women only last year. So it's just a snapshot. But what I'm actually going to do, this is a bit of a test for you in the audience, is what I want you to do is keep this in the forefront of your mind when you're thinking about Aboriginal women in business. Okay? And then when we start to talk about what exists for Aboriginal women in business or participating in the economy, is to think about what that actually looks like and how we're going to frame that. There's also a question in amongst these, so I need you to pay attention. No sneezing, okay? So, in 2011, there was just under 3,000 Aboriginal women in business, or that said that they were in business. Our age. We had a younger age profile than non-Indigenous women. So 56% were under 45 years of age, compared to non-Aboriginal people being non-Aboriginal women being 43%. The industries that we represented were mainly across healthcare and social assistance services, retail trade and other services, and they included industries such as repair and maintenance of mechanical, electrical and other goods, personal care, hair, diet and beauty services, funeral services, photographic film processing and religious services. So they're the top 10 industries that we worked in. When it came to occupations, the occupations were likely to be broad occupations that we identified with, and they were clerical and administrative work, professionals or managers, and these were the sorts of occupations that were in that top 10, so bookkeepers, retail managers, again hairdressing was right at the top, secretaries and domestic cleaners. When we talk about artists, and I think in Australia quite often we have this image around what our Aboriginal art represents, and quite often people think dot painting straight away. But artists is much broader, arts and crafts, particularly in an Aboriginal sense. So we're actually talking also about visual arts. But around 47 Aboriginal women who were artists and were involved in visual arts or crafts, and out of that total of 307, identified themselves only as business owners. So that's quite significant about how they self-identified. So my question in amongst that is, from Aboriginal women transitioning from informal to formal participation, is there a key to that? Is there something significant in the way that we need to make strategies in relation to transitioning women from informal, Aboriginal women, from informal participation to formal participation in the economy? And this example is about my mother's hobby, as she calls it. So just to continue Heather's theme of story, my mother has a hobby of doing jewellery, which I'll wear today as well. She also she makes this from Kwandong nuts. So she goes out during spring and summertime and collects Kwandongs from off the trees with her sisters and her cousin. She uses the fruit from that to make jam. So we're in the development world where we have Thermomix, which makes things a lot easier. I tell you. And a great investment. I should have got some sponsorship, I think. But it helps us to expedite that process, particularly with kids in the house. But she makes the Kwandong jam to sell, and she sells that to a local tourist centre, just as a bit of pocket money. But she also spends a lot of time drilling and branding and writing women's stories that are attached to her hobby, as she calls it, which is called Yoga Wankening. Yoga Wankening means women talking in Noongar language. The women's stories that are attached to that are creation stories from my country. So this necklace that I wear today is actually the women's campfire. This is about the women's campfire and the women's fire being kept strong in my country. So this is about me as a businesswoman trying to encourage my mother to enter into business. When we talk about income generated, just under half of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women in business had no employees, compared with 44% of non-Indigenous women. And around 5% had 20 or more employees. So Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander business operators were slightly more than likely to be working full-time, so just slightly more than non-Aboriginal women. So they actually went into work as a more means of their main bulk of income. Around 1 in 5 worked between 1 and 15 hours, and 22% of them worked 49 hours or more. Almost a quarter of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women in business had a weekly personal income less than $1,000, compared with 66% of non-Aboriginal women, and only 1 in 5 had a weekly personal income between $400 and $600 per week. When we think about geographical location, this is probably the most important component to this statistical information. And it's the majority, which is 69% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women who are business operators, lived in major cities or inner regional areas of Australia. But they were also more likely to live in remote or very remote areas of Australia than non-Aboriginal women. So they were actually more likely to be in a remote area than non-Aboriginal women, which is evident in lots of the northern states of Australia, such as WA, Northern Territory and Queensland. What that means, though, is that when we start talking about what we're doing in the government space, this is really important to bring that profile of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women into that. So we start looking at the economic development plan that's currently on part of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. The point of this that I want to raise with you is that improving education and employment outcomes and increasing the number of Indigenous businesses operating across Australia have no reference to gender. That is actually just for all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. When we think about that economic development relies on Indigenous entrepreneurship, community support and leadership, and private sector investment and involvement, that's important. But also creating business and employment opportunities for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people has been through the procurement guidelines that have been offered in relation to attracting more business for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the economy. It's also that we needed to look at, if we're going to increase economic independence and reduce the reliance on welfare, that again we need to have a gendered reference. We need to have a gendered reference in relation to what the research already says about if we increase women participating in the economy, if we have better economic empowerment, we will have better results. We will have better results across lots of different areas. So how is this happening? The governments are putting together a strategic framework to boost investment in Indigenous business, and the Indigenous procurement policy has already funded 52 Indigenous businesses, valued at $36 million. But it's not clear from that whether how many of those actually belong to women or actually women have benefited from those. So Indigenous culture, traditional Indigenous culture, has new opportunities for economic development, and that If you look at that within the frame of the quadruple bottom line, as they call it, which includes not just economic, but social, environmental, and also cultural development. Land is also a significant asset base for Aboriginal people, and the issue with that is it's wrapped up in native title. So a native title does need to play a point, and does from a legislative point of view, and for us to capitalise on access to that, we actually need to look at the Indigenous land use agreements and the economic benefit that comes with those. The Indigenous and Enterprise Development is based, again, looking at the high need for remote communities and their distance to larger markets and the cost of doing business. But again, when we go back to those statistics, a small portion of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women live in remote areas. Again, that 69% of us live in major cities and in urban areas. So when we look at getting the right help at the right time and access to finance, we need to also look at the digital literacy for women, the access to the internet for women. We know that those statistics are much less on a global level, not just to mention on an Australian level. And the importance of NBN in relation to linking up our remote communities. So the challenges for Aboriginal women's economic participation is that we actually do have slightly different and distinct needs from the traditional mainstream women's economic empowerment. Some of the commitments that we have are quite extraordinary. And the reason that they're quite extraordinary is it's the extension of kinship. So our family and caring responsibilities for children and other extended families, our informal and formal mentoring, our community and volunteering positions on local boards, our paid and part-time and full-time work, our study and self-development programs. So I'm going to give you, like Heather, a bit of an insight into my personal story. So as I said, I'm the mother of two daughters. My daughters are 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. I work part-time in a project officer role. I run my own consultancy business, and I have three research projects, and one of those I'm the main contract holder, and I have four other community development-based projects. I'm working on two other startup businesses. I study online as a postgrad student, and every second week I have shared care of my two nephews. One of those is also two, and the other one is nine. As my brother and sister-in-law work in FIFO positions in WA. My sister-in-law is one of the only Indigenous female electrical apprentices at Rio Tinto. So her position is quite significant, but she would not be able to return after maternity leave if she didn't have the support of family. My mentorship to other micro and small business owners within my family, again, trying to transition my mother into the formal economy, is a full-time job, and as is my cousin who has recently set up a construction business. My representation and advocacy on not just local but also state and national boards takes up my time. Some days I'm allowed to get more than 6 hours sleep. But these are the challenges for women to participate, Aboriginal women to participate in the economy. My experience at the Policy and Partnership Forum for Women in the Economy in Lima, Peru in June was a great experience. WPPE, as it's called, has five pillars of women's economic empowerment. And they are access to capital, access to market, skills and capacity building, women's leadership and agency, and innovation and technology. PPWE this year in Lima had a key theme of breaking barriers to economic integration of women in the global market. What it did, it actually chose five sub-themes as part of that, and they were around economic care systems, so that was about unpaid domestic work and the redistribution of caring responsibilities for children and other families. The cost of gender-based violence in the context of economic development, digital literacy for economic inclusion, mechanisms for internationalising women-led MSMEs, which is micro, small, medium enterprises for women, financial and economic literacy for inclusion and access to capital. One of the very significant wins we had as part of the international negotiations, and also a credit to our Ambassador for Women and Girls, Natasha Slot-Despoja, was her TED-style talk on gender-based violence and the importance to make sure that men and boys are part of the conversation. And this was a critical turning point and the first time APEC have actually included any dialogue into their written statement around inclusion of men and boys. So it's actually quite a good win for us. When we talked about gender-based violence, we also talked about it being so prevalent within homes, workplaces, public spaces, and its adverse effects, so in the context of economic development. We also talked about the importance of how the negative impact on future human capital and its intergenerational consequences, and this is particularly important for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. There was also acknowledgement in paragraph 18 around better working environments and healthier motivated employees, having positive economic effects, and the increase in productivity and profits. We needed to frame that in relation to the main APEC forum actually embracing this because it's driven through economic development. We encourage the other APEC economies at region and local level in conjunction with private sector. In lots of areas, this is driven by the public sector, not so much by the private sector and also by the non-government sector, but to disseminate information and facilitate communication campaigns to prevent and protect women from violence. We also talked a lot about helping women who have experienced violence within the workplace to have supportive mechanisms set up. So actually having within workplace agreements different legislation that allows women to take lead and not for that not to be questioned. This was probably the most successful for me on a personal level at the APEC forum, and this was paragraph 26. And this reference text was actually put forward by Mexico. And I can tell you, I was sitting at the table on behalf of the Australian government on this day, and when the Mexican government actually put this text up, there were about five other lights that came on for people's microphones at the same time. And Australia was one of those, so I was quick on the mark, to endorse the text of the importance of including regional and rural and remote issues, but also the context of Indigenous women being change agents when it comes to economic empowerment. So that was really important. It actually was one of the quickest texts that passed through. It was through 2 minutes and 36 seconds rather than being debated. I actually timed it. In the final paragraph, the importance of having an intercultural approach in policies was encouraged as well. This is different from having an intersectional approach. An intercultural approach is about us learning from each other and also making sure that it's about advancing and recognising the demands for women around empowerment. In meeting as part of the bilateral program with Indigenous women in Peru, I had an insight into the difficulty for Indigenous women in Latin America. And one of those difficult issues is they talked about their census. In their census, there are two language groups. And you can only choose from those two language groups which one you belong to. There are 44 Indigenous languages in Peru, just alone. So in their census, they do not even identify and recognise the Indigenous languages of their country, which is very sad. So most of the Indigenous women that I met with in this photograph actually said, we don't identify as being an Indigenous woman because our language group is not listed in the census data. It was very difficult for Natasha and I to sit and listen to that because in Australia, again, we have similar experience that we don't identify Indigenous languages that exist across Australia. But one of the good practice examples that they provided to us was actually around the economic rights and empowerment in Latin America for women. And this was about providing technical support. Microsoft actually also gave a very good textile talk. And at the end of my presentation, I've actually put some links to those presentations so you can have a look at those. They were mainly around STEM, so women in STEM. But this particular good practice example also talks to the impact of climate change as well and how they've managed to embrace that. So if any advice I could give to Heather as part of being the CEO at ANROADS is the emerging issue, and I don't think it's emerging, I think we've been a little bit ignorant to this conversation around gender and climate change. 2013, I was at the CSW 57 session, and the Indigenous women there talked about climate change. And we all went, huh? No, that doesn't impact on us. It's impacting us every day. And we need to be cognizant of the impact, particularly under our Women, Peace and Security framework that we have here in Australia. It's very important. So good piece of research for the future. But this example in Peru is actually reaching in that short time frame between 2013 and 2015, 400 women in Peru that have increased the women's participation in public spaces and their capacity to influence policies of Indigenous women's economic rights and ending violence against women. It's had such an enormous reach. And it's actually leading the APEC region in relation to women's empowerment, particularly in the economic space. When we look forward to CSW 61 next year and those priority themes and the review themes, particularly around the implementation of the Millennium Development Goals, I also want to talk to the importance of having a framework that sits for the Sustainable Development Goals. So the five P's. And the five P's are around prosperity, people, partnership, the planet, and peace. As part of my closing comments, what I'd really like to say is it's crucial that mainstream gender issues integrate special needs and concerns of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women into policies, programs and budgets. Compiling disaggregated data, both qualitative and quantitative, and taking into account local and regional cultural, social and economic differences in relation to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women's issues. increasing women's capacity in decision-making and political participation will ensure that the adequate number of Indigenous women are placed in positions of political leadership as well as in governments and public administration. Improving access to education and skills development will allow Aboriginal women to take advantage of training and employment opportunities and to strengthen programs in Indigenous communities to ensure the benefits of Indigenous women and girls, I want to add to that. So access to higher education is something that we report on as part of CEDAW, but in fact, we aren't doing anything within our tertiary institutions to increase Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women's access to or completion of higher education, in particular reference to STEM or STEAM. So science, technology, economics and mathematics, but also of recent they also include arts. Within the development processes, we must change development processes and practices that work to improve or enhance capacities for Indigenous peoples, including Indigenous women. In doing so, that ensure economic and social development does not undermine their dignity and capacity, the traditional autonomy and the process of decision-making and their self-determination. That, in fact, is the end of my presentation. So thank you all for your attention in that. And
thank you, Dorinda, for your wonderful presentation. Are there questions for Dorinda?
I think that the regulation around childcare is probably one of the biggest challenges. I know within Western Australia there's been lots of concentration on regulation of carers, particularly for family daycares, and I think that that's been problematic, particularly when we have grandparents. We have, in Western Australia, a high proportion of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander kids that are in care. And those children are in care through our child protection system, particularly with family. And what that does is actually hamstrings families in relation to their ability then to be able to access childcare opportunities for economic growth within families. I think then it sort of like runs in a bit of a circle, so it keeps going around that revolving door in relation to actually looking at things from a holistic perspective, that if there are social issues within families and within Aboriginal communities, we have to look at strategies to put infrastructure in place to solve some of those. But also, we have to support families, so we can't just be removing children from that because of an issue that we think is too difficult to solve or put into the too hard basket. We actually need to work with this from a holistic perspective in order to get economic growth being the eventual outcome. If that means supporting people that are caring, family daycare or childcare opportunities, I think we need to look at that from an infrastructure perspective. Again, training and development has a big role to play in relation to training people and making sure that we actually keep the regulations so that they are about child safety, but also they're not restrictive in a way, particularly for regional, rural and remote areas of Australia. So I think that there's lots of, and it's probably a whole length of issues that exist in that, but I think governments need to work better in collaboration across the top and joining up some of those services, because what's tending to happen is we're thinking of childcare just as in isolation of itself when it's actually wrapped up in a continuum of issues. So we actually have to look at it much more holistically. Trace?
Hello, I'm Tracy Mekos. Dorinda, I'm very interested in the idea of learning from Aboriginal culture for the mainstream, because I think we do the opposite. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we say to you, what do you poor people want? And actually, for about that, as I've been travelling, I've been Indigenous community.
do that by carving out a space for Indigenous women, for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, simply through this process and through other processes in our consultative processes to actually hear about some of our names. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, and in particular, but also in our communities, have survived. We're a surviving nation of people. And we have mechanisms within our communities that are both functional and dysfunctional, but work for us. And so I think that there definitely is some learnings there, Tracy, and I think it's about us actually paying attention to what's working in those communities and why it's working. So I think that if we do that, there are learnings for the mainstream, particularly from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. So thank you. I know we don't have time in this short presentation that I have, but there are some YouTube clips. The Vimo one is actually from the Asia Indigenous Pacific Indigenous Peoples Pact, and it's actually around the rights of Indigenous women. So it's actually a really good short clip that only lasts about 2.5 minutes. The YouTube clip is actually about girls in STEM. So that's the Microsoft one that was presented at APEC. And the other one is about women in business and economic empowerment. So if you get an opportunity to look at any of those, I urge you to.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dorinda, for your wonderful presentation. And I did want to take this moment to thank Dorinda on behalf of the United Nations Association for this absolutely beautiful message, Steve, and the message that we've received here. And with your permission, Dorinda, I'll share that message. Is that appropriate?
Yep.
Thank you. The message stick is a form of communication traditionally used by Indigenous Australians. These are used to provide information or relay messages between groups. The message stick contains my message for the forum and starts its journey from my home place in Perth, Western Australia, to the National Forum on Economic Empowerment for Women and Girls in Melbourne, Victoria. I've been asked to provide a keynote speech on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women's economic empowerment. The journey starts by describing me. I'm a woman with children, as I have the Kulin, who traditionally comes from the red-tailed black cockatoo people, mother's country for the Yuit people of the Noongar Nation of Indigenous Australia. I have also used the Southern Cross Star to symbolise Australia as it is important to our nation. My message comes from my elders, in particular my women, and how we could make life better. I am asked to provide leadership as the keynote speaker and sharing my leadership story from APEC 2016 Women in the Economy Forum in Lima, Peru in June. In my country, we call this turtle dreaming, where the larger freshwater turtle creates the vision or dream for others, community people, to follow. I've included environmental symbols on the message stick to represent outcomes that are not always economic, but more social and cultural development. I took a long journey to come to Melbourne, to a place near water, Yarra River. This meeting had lots of important people with authority representing their organisations and governments who came with a message. This forum will inform the work of our nation. Therefore, it brings us together as a group with a shared history, walking on this journey together. It's an absolute honour to be able to read your words, Dorinda, and it feels to me slightly awkward to be reading them with you here, but it was just such an inspirational presentation, I think, for all of us. And I think the point that was elucidated in the question and answer with Tracy is that there's a lot for us to learn. And one of the key learnings, I think, from this wonderful presentation is that this is not just about economic empowerment. It must be about social empowerment, cultural empowerment, and respect for the environment. We cannot ignore the question about climate change any longer in this conversation. So thank you so much for that wisdom. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this special podcast from Broad on Joy 94.9 at the National Forum on the Economic Empowerment of Women and Girls, held at the Novotel in Collins Street, Melbourne. It ran from the 5th to the 6th of September 2016. And thanks to the United Nations Association of Australia and Sophie Arnold.
Thank you. You've been listening to a broadcast on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.